welcome your backup plan tribe. I'm so happy to be here with you guys today. Wow. If you are new here, welcome. Welcome. I hope you like, share, and subscribe down here in the corner button. Make sure you press on that subscribe button so that you get more shows like this. And thank you for coming on our shows and watching. I'm trying to get the word out there for all types of shows because I'm Tina and I'm with your Backup Plan app. I'm the creator and developer of your Backup Plan. I'm a best-selling author of In the Blink of an Eye. Just like that, your life changes in a flash, in the blink, in a snap of your fingers. Your life is ever, forever changed. And I know our guest today is going to talk about just that as well. We are on all podcast platforms, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, LinkedIn, and of course, Pinterest. And I wish there was a song about that where you could go, you know, podcast platforms, YouTube, Facebook. I don't know. I'm going to have to work on that one or get someone that sings that can do that one for me. We talk about real life stories here with really amazing people, just like our guest today from Chicago, on our shows about their life changing events and how quickly things change. Tragedies, traumas, something life changing, car accidents, you name it. We have seen it all on the show. And in the blink of an eye, your life can change in a quick second, because sometimes we don't get that 5-minute evacuation notice. You know, sometimes there's no time at all to make that right choice, to be in the mindset, to be in the right decisions, to make have those right emotions, to make those decisions, and to be in the right mental state of mind. And we don't have choices in many cases. It just happens right in front of our eyes. And we wonder, are we prepared? Are we? Are you? Is your neighbor? Is your sister? Is your mom and dad? That's the big question. Are we prepared? And so that being said, I'm so excited to have Michelle Valiakinis from Chicago here. Our show is called Parenting After a Loss, Michelle's Perspective on Overcoming Grief. And I am going to have her come on, and we are going to go to a quick commercial break, and I'll be back in a quick second. Welcome back to our show. You're back with your backup plan, and my name is Tina Ginn, and we are going to bring on our special guest today. She comes from Chicago. Her name is Michelle Valiakinis, and she is founder and executive director of Colette Louise Tisdale Foundation. I'm so thrilled to have you on our show today, Michelle. Thank you. Where did this whole journey start for you?
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me on. I'm really, I'm always glad to share my story because I think it's a story that resonates with a lot of people and that's just not talked about enough.
Absolutely. It sure isn't.
Yeah. So, you know, first and foremost, I'm a mom. I'm a mom of three, only one living child. And I think that I say it that way, and a lot of people are surprised when I say it that way. But to me, I'm a mom to all three of them. And it just looks different in each one of them. And right. So, you know, our journey to parenthood, my husband and I got married. We were, I was 34 when we got married. And so, we started trying pretty quickly and thought, you know, we were both pretty healthy people. We didn't think anything of it, thought, you know, everything that I had been told about it was seemed easy to get pregnant. I thought we would do that. And what we found was that it wasn't. And so we ultimately...
And in a lot of cases, it's not.
Right.
For many people.
Oh, my God. I mean, you hear all these...
Some people wait. And then... Right. Get their careers done and then wait and then right. Find out they can't have any.
Right. And so we went and got tested for infertility issues. And basically they came back and said, yeah, you have a diagnosis of infertility. The reason? We don't know. Which is really frustrating, especially this day and age, that you can have that kind of you know, it's like, okay, tell me what's wrong. Let's fix something. Right. And they couldn't. And so we started fertility treatments. On our first round of IVF, we did several procedures before that, but on our first round of IVF, I got pregnant and we were thrilled. We were finally pregnant. So we were like shouting it from the rooftops and that kind of thing.
Static.
And then I lost that baby. So that's our sweet pea, our oldest, when I was about 7 weeks pregnant.
Oh, right at the near the beginning.
Right near the beginning. And then, you know, that just throws you for a loop. And it's really, it's hard to like live in that of, you know, prior to that happening,
all of that,
you know, stuff. Prior to that thing, I just was so obsessed about getting pregnant that I hadn't stopped to think about the fact that like, that wasn't an end all be all. That didn't translate into baby necessarily in the way I had visioned it, in the way, you know, I think most people trying for kids vision.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it was really, it was hard on my husband and I, and I think we were both grieving and both angry. And I think, you know, really took it out on each other and really turned sort of against each other instead of leaning on each other. And, you know, I'm happy to say we went through couples counseling because we really thought it was important. We really needed to focus on this and get past this big hurdle. Because we were going to still keep trying, right? So it wasn't going to go away. This wasn't just a fluke thing. And I'm really
glad to deal with it, right?
Right.
How to deal with it.
And I'm really glad that we did that because I think that was so important as our journey continued. And so on our third round of IVF, I got pregnant with our daughter, Colette. And, you know, pretty normal pregnancy. I will tell you, I am not a good pregnant person. So I was constantly sick. Morning sickness is like the worst named thing ever, I think.
I know. You don't have to tell me about that.
It was all day long, you know, and it just was hard. But otherwise, it was a pretty normal pregnancy. You know, things were moving along. Things were doing well. When I was 21 weeks pregnant, I went to a standard OB appointment, was feeling actually the best I had felt the entire pregnancy, was kind of like, oh, this is what they mean when second trimester starts feeling better. I'm feeling better. Okay, great. And my blood pressure was reading 188 over 110. And so my OB was like, I'm really concerned about this. And they had waited and tried to, you know, give me time to see if it would improve. Did not. And so my OB ultimately said, I need you to go to the hospital and go to labor and delivery. She stayed very calm, which I'm always grateful for. And she said, okay, you know, you need to go do this. And so we left and joked on the way that, you know, it was going to be that I was worried about, you know, hearing baby's heartbeat and I was worried about this and all of that. And then now that we had heard that, we were going to show up and they were going to laugh at us at the hospital because my blood pressure was going to be totally normal. And that's where we went in thinking, you know, and so I remember my husband dropping me off and going into labor and delivery and the security desk asked me who I was coming to visit and me saying like, no, I'm the patient because I wasn't really showing at that point. And went in and that was not, they did not laugh at us. And in fact, my blood pressure had actually, increased slightly by the time we got there. And then, while there, kind of, you know, went up a little bit and then, you know, just played around.
Fluctuated a bit.
Fluctuated. Yes. Thank you. And so they started talking about, they were admitting me and I had no idea really what was going on. They were talking about a 24-hour urine test. And so that's why I thought I had to be admitted was to do that test. So I was still thinking I was going to be out in a night or two. And, you know, finally when they got me to a space and they said, you know, you're going to be admitted and we were just waiting for my more permanent room. My husband turned to me and said, our poor dog had not been out all day.
Oh, no.
We had both gone to work and then gone to this OB appointment and then gone to the hospital. And so it was probably, you know, 11:30 midnight. He hadn't been out all day. So he said, I'm going to go home and then I'll get some things for you. And I was like, okay, no problem. And my OB's partner, who was on call, finished with deliveries and came in and said, do you know what's going on? And I said, no. And she said, you have preeclampsia. It's severe and you are being admitted and you will be here until you deliver.
Oh dear.
And just to give you a frame of reference, like with weeks, is like, that was the evening of May 8th. I was not due until September 7th. So, you know, that's a long time to go. And so, you know, kind of, talk about being thrown for every curveball, right?
Yeah.
And everything that, you know, came flooding to my mind. And I remember her asking me, do you have any questions? And I was like, I have a million questions and I don't even know where to start.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, and it was everything from the like really mundane of like, we don't have a car seat. We don't have a crib. We don't have, you know, all of this stuff, to the really scary of like, am I going to survive this? At that point, I will say the only thing I knew about preeclampsia at that moment was an old episode of ER is a woman dies in the emergency room of preeclampsia. And that was the only memory. That was like the only knowledge I knew of it. So to be sitting there and being told there's this diagnosis and think I'm going to die is really, you know, just kind of consumes you.
Yeah.
And so that was what I did. You know, my full-time job went from, you know, what I was doing to I was here and I wanted to be.
You're stuck there now.
As long as possible, right? It all of a sudden, you know, I'm like, it's like, I've got to cook this baby as long as possible. And you know, it's just, it's really scary. And they're coming in and they're telling you about, you know, viability and survival rates. And if you make it to this week and if you make it to that week and, you know, you're just I had more time. I mean, I had more time to do all of this stuff.
I just started. And,
right. And I think having gone through all of the struggles to get there, really feeling even more let, you know, just frustrated and let down by the whole procedure of like, we went through all of this. And so this part should be easy, right?
Yeah.
And now it's not. And so
you think that's God's way of telling you you're not going to have any babies?
You know, I have a very complicated relationship with God. I was very religious before, or I don't never want to say very religious because I feel like that kind of has a misnomer, but
yeah.
I found a lot of solace in my faith and my religion and in God. And after having experienced everything and my loss, I don't find any solace in it. And I don't find any solace in that idea. And I did have all of those thoughts along the way, you know, when we would have these struggles, sort of just like, is this the universe, the God, whatever you want to say, way of saying I'm not supposed to be a mom, and then trying to reconcile
that
I had always wanted to have kids. I had always dreamed of being pregnant. You know, and so what did this all mean when I have to, you know, change that or think about changing that? What does that mean? What does that look like? And so I was in the hospital for a little over 3 weeks, really just spending time in the hospital. And, you know, I was able to do a little bit of work from there, which helped with just, you know.
Was that like the fourth and fifth month then? That you were in there?
Yeah. So I was in there from 21 weeks to 24 weeks. And so at 24 weeks and 5 days. So when I was first admitted, they did an ultrasound and they said, we are concerned. She is measuring behind, about 2 weeks behind schedule. They said, you know, the ultrasound, we give some leeway of about a week. So really we're talking about, we're worried about a week behind. Our hope is, once we control your blood pressure and we're keeping an eye on you and we can adjust as we need to, that there will be some catch up of growth. And when they did a repeat ultrasound 3 weeks later, there had been no catch up. In fact, there had been no growth in those 3 weeks.
Wow.
And so the doctors came to us and said, really, we recommend delivering today because there's just more we can do on the outside than we can while you're still carrying her. And so we went to You know, emergency C-section, 24 weeks and 5 days, 24.
Which is what, 6 weeks, 6 months? Is that, trying to think of.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. About,
that's kind of like the earliest that they can take a baby, isn't it?
So across the board, hospitals will say the 24 weeks is viability. Some hospitals will do it sooner. Our hospital would not. So if we had been given the option when I was first admitted, that if we wanted to deliver, we would deliver. They would not intervene medically, and we would just hold her as she passed. We chose to wait, really just hoping that we could do this. And so we got to 24 weeks, and that was like a huge sigh of relief when we did that. Yeah. And so, but we knew, I mean, it was still very early, and, you know, it was very scary, and we were still cautioned things like, you know, they said we will intervene medically, but if the smallest tube does not fit, if it's too big, there's not much we can do. And so we knew there was all these risks just going in to deliver her, you know, of what was doing this. She came out, the second to smallest tube fit her. We were thrilled. I remember saying, of course, this is my badass daughter, and she's going to defy all of your expectations because that's what she's going to do.
Yeah.
And she did. You know, she went straight to NICU. And, you know, nobody is prepared to have a child in NICU.
No.
My younger sister was a preemie, so some of my earliest memories were 4 years apart. So some of my earliest memories involved the NICU and her being sick and all of that. So I thought I was prepared. Yeah, no, when it's your own kid, you're not prepared. There's just nothing that prepares you for it. And, you know, I expected that when I gave birth to her, I was going to hold her, and I didn't get to hold her. And, you know, I didn't expect her to look so tiny and, you know, just all of that. And
how big was she? Do you remember?
She was just over a pound.
Oh my, that's so small.
And so very tiny, because she was so early. We still don't know what color eyes she would have had, because her eyes were still shut. You know, you were seeing her with all these tubes and wires. Nothing, you know, none of that is what we expected in the, you know, the journey that we'd been through. We didn't expect any of this. And then I was recovering from, you know, pretty massive surgery. And so trying to heal physically, having emotional with hormones dropping, I don't know if I had any sort of postpartum mental health issues. I think I might have. I was prone to them because I had had anxiety beforehand. So even early on in the pregnancy, I was planning with my therapist and my psychiatrist of, you know, where was I going to go if I needed help? What was I going to do? Who was checking in on me? All of that. We were coming up with all those plans, even that early in the pregnancy. Right. You know, so I think I don't know if I did have those. And so it was 9 days of just up and down. You know, I think the best thing my mom, who was a preemie mom, told me was, it's a roller coaster and you just have to hang on. And she said, you're going to start some days thinking your baby is doing so well and end them thinking differently and vice versa. And you might even go back and forth within the same day. And that's really what it was. And I feel like that was some of the best stuff that my mom could have told me. And, you know, so we settled into our routine. I was released from the hospital a couple days later. It is really terrible to go home without your baby.
That must be tough.
You know, that is really tough. And I, you know, again, I mean, right, talking about being prepared, I thought I was prepared for it. I hadn't been home in, you know, 4 weeks or whatever it was by that point. And so I thought I wanted to, and we made it out of the hospital and, you know, drove a little bit. And then I burst into tears because that was not supposed to be part of the plan. You know, we were supposed to have a baby in the back seat when I was released. And so.
And to leave her there too.
Right. And it's just, yeah, it's a terrible, terrible feeling. And there is no preparing for that. No. Because we all sort of think the same thing about having babies is, you know, and then you get to take the baby home, right?
Yeah.
And
like leaving your arm there.
Right. Not getting to just doesn't factor into your thought process.
Yeah.
And so.
And no one can look after her better than you can. Right.
Right. So. Of course. You know, but then you're also afraid. Like, I mean, I think the NICU experience is very interesting. And, you know, in my work now, I do a lot of, you know, talking to medical professionals and saying, like, let them be parents. Because a lot of times, and I know I felt this, and I know so many, you know, parents have said this, is they feel like they're asking permission to do something with their child, right? So, like, can I hold my child? Am I, you know, I'm asking permission. Can I do this? Can I do that? And it's really, you know, it takes away that whole feeling of being a parent. You know, you're supposed to navigate all of this. And when you have medical professionals who are kind of in there and, you know, for better or for worse, sometimes are taking the lead, it's really hard to experience that and to feel like you are being a parent. Yeah. And so, yeah. And so we went, so 9 days, ups, downs, everything in between. And we had settled into a little bit of a routine. So we would wake up in the morning, my husband would head into work. On his way into work, he would call and talk to the nurse and see how she was doing. He would then let me know, because I was moving slower than normal. And I also had to go back in a few times to my OB's office for blood pressure checks. I would, you know, kind of take my time, and then I would take a lift over to the hospital because I couldn't drive yet. And I would basically stay there most of the day, and my husband would come after work, and we would spend a little bit of time together with her, and then we would head home. And so that was the you know, kind of routine we had settled into.
Yeah.
And on her 9th day, my husband called and then called me and said, yeah. So when I called to talk to the nurse, they put the doctor on the phone. And so, you know, those are sort of like those warning signs, right? You know, something's not good when they pull the doctor to get on the phone with you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I quickly got ready and headed out the door, and went to the hospital, and, you know, really in like a state of denial and a state of like, I know I need to be here, but like, this isn't really happening. Nothing's really happening. And when I got there, the doctor said, oh, you know, mom, let's talk. And I said, okay. And he said, let me find a room for us. And I thought, this is not good, you know? And he did, you know, he came in and talked to me. And ultimately what had happened was, with preemies that small, they typically put them straight onto a ventilator that is very powerful. And they like to have them on there for usually 24 to 48 hours to get them strong enough, their lungs strong enough. And then they will switch ventilators. Colette could never switch to the other ventilator. They tried over and over again, and her numbers would start to plummet. So they would put her back on the original ventilator. It's very powerful, and it's very helpful, and it saves a lot of preemies' lives. But it also, a prolonged stay on it, can also start to shred the lungs. And that was essentially what had happened. They could not get her onto another ventilator, and this now was having an effect on her lungs and not supporting her at all. And so, you know, the doctor told me all of this and told me that I would have to, you know, kind of said, you know, I think you should call your husband. And I just was in denial. I mean, to me, it was like, this was, you know, sort of just talk. I kind of felt like in a lot of ways he was like Charlie Brown's teacher, you know, just like, I didn't really even understand what he was saying because this wasn't going to happen. Right. You know?
Yeah.
I think I was prepared. I think
like you were in a different world.
Right. I think I was prepared to lose her in the first day or two. But once she made it past 2 or 3 days, I was really anticipating and planning, like, what's it going to look like when she comes home, thinking she was going to have medical issues, maybe disabilities. So I was thinking of things like, okay, we don't have a bedroom on the first floor. Could we make something into a bedroom on the first floor if, you know, stairs are going to be too hard for us to do with her.
To be closer. You
know, how are we going to do this? And I was thinking of those kinds of things. Oh, we have stairs. Can we get a ramp in? You know, all of that. I was thinking of those kinds of things because that's what I thought the world was going to be.
Yeah.
And instead, you know, here was somebody telling me, and not even using the words, was not even using the words of death, was using very much euphemisms. And so it was also hard to really like grasp that. And the moment when I really kind of knew something, he turned to leave. He told me, you can have this room for as long as you want. And he turned to leave, and then he stopped and he turned around and he said, do you believe in baptism? And I said, yes, I do. And he said, I think it's time to arrange that. And that was my like click that, oh, this is really serious when they're saying this. And so I called my husband, I burst into tears, and, you know, we spent the day, just kind of there and watching her. I really still kept thinking that she was going to just, you know, take a surprising turn and pull through. I mean, it wasn't occurring to me. And then the thing I remember was that the rules of the NICU, and this is very common in NICUs, is during shift changes, that's the only time the parents are kicked out. So you can usually access the NICU 24 hours a day. COVID changed some of the stuff, so this might not totally be true. But at the time, this was in 2018, you could come in at any time except during those shift changes. And so we were coming up to a shift change, and my mother-in-law had gotten there, and she went in with my husband. It was only two people at a time. And so I was in a separate room with my sister and my sister-in-law. And I was like, we'll take this break. We'll go eat, whatever. And then, you know, we'll come back and we'll kind of regroup. And a nurse came in and said, Mom, we need you. And all of a sudden I realized we were going to be allowed in during the shift change. We weren't being kicked out. And that was sort of one of those like aha moments of this is really serious. And so, you know, right at the time that I think the doctor was turning to us to basically like, this is, you know, you might have to make a decision. I screamed in my head. I don't know to this day if I screamed out loud. and I just said, Colette, please don't make me make this decision. Please don't. Yeah. And almost instantly, as if she heard me, her numbers started to plummet on their own. And that was really when I knew. And so they kept her alive. She got baptized. And then they allowed us to take her into a room. And so our parents and our sisters and our brothers-in-law were all in there. And we got to hold her for the first time. And the doctor came back in and had to check twice. There has to be no heartbeat twice for them to call it as a death. And so we all got to hold her and we cried and, you know, it's surreal, right? I mean, I remember somebody once telling me the first time that they had held their child, that their whole life, like everything changed. And I did not anticipate it to the level it was. The first time I got to hold my child was as she died.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And, you know, I mean, nothing in the world can prepare you for that. And, you know, nothing should, right? No parent should ever have to, you know, like, I mean, you understand the world when you start understanding death and life and everything is, you know, you anticipate you're going to have to bury your parents. You anticipate all of this stuff. You do not expect to bury your children. And, you know, and in a fair world and a just world, I don't know, nobody would have to. No parent would ever have to experience that.
No, because sometimes births are in a bathroom or in a gas station or at a store or on the highway or in a field somewhere. I mean, she's frozen. See if she comes back to us. Here, there she is back.
There he is. Yes. Sorry about that. I don't know what happened.
You just froze for a second. Yeah, okay. It's just people have babies everywhere and you just don't think that there's this other kind of birth that happened, and that's crazy. I don't even know how you get through that.
Right. And, you know, it's hard to explain this because, so I'm sitting here and we're actually just a couple weeks away from our 5-year anniversary of doing this. And
if you would have talked to me, 5 years?
It both feels like, I can't believe it's already been 5 years. And how has it only been 5 years all at the same time?
Yeah.
You know, if you had told me 5 years and 2 months ago, I would have said, and I've heard this said to me before, is, I don't know how you survived that. And I would have said that. I don't know how I would survive it.
Yeah.
And I don't. I still don't know. Right. And, you know, it is being plunged into a world that is unimaginable.
Not fair.
It's not fair. You are angry. I felt so much guilt. I mean, I still struggle sometimes with guilt, right? My body didn't protect her. My body didn't do what it was supposed to do. And so am I to blame on that? You know, and I've really held that very, very much. And
yeah.
What does this mean? Right. I mean, what's, you know, I spent, so she died May 31st and I spent that summer running around to every imaginable doctor because I was convinced something was wrong with me. They were going to find it and then we could treat it. And then this was never going to happen ever again in the future.
Right.
And what I found out was that there wasn't anything. And that's super scary.
Yeah.
You know, is that you think, oh, okay, I know how to deal with this. I'll find out what's wrong with me and then I'll fix it. And there's nothing wrong with you. And so that's really just, it's a completely scary thing. I then had to worry about, you know, I had never had blood pressure issues prior to this. To this day, I'm still on blood pressure medicine. You know, and I had to regroup what that looked like. And we had to do all of this in a world in which we still wanted to bring a child home. Time was not really on our side at this point.
Plus, you know, you go home and you're still without the baby. And
right. And
you have this feeling
of
loss.
Right. And I felt like I had all of this, you know, maternal energy. And I just couldn't do anything with it. And that was really, hard for me. And that was really, you know, just all consuming. And I'm going to walk with you in the computer because I just realized I need to plug this in. So,
oh, sure, sure.
I'm just going to walk with you. But
yeah, that's crazy. The feelings must have just been all over the place, especially the next day when you're at home.
Right.
I think.
Right. Yeah. Oh, for sure. Definitely.
Because you're was that a nightmare I had or like?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, in a lot of ways, I still feel this way. We're going to see a tour through my probably messy house, hopefully. That doesn't show up too much.
That just means you're normal.
you're
just,
you know,
a normal person.
Right. And I have a toddler and, you know, he rules this house. So I usually say it's Elliot's world. We just get a chance to live in it. So
yeah, that's cute.
But, you know,
so how
I think,
did you get past that part now? How did you get through,
you know,
that?
I mean, I think, it's a few things, right? It's a lot of work. It's, feeling a lot of things and allowing yourself to feel those things. It's being kind to yourself and being grace, you know, giving yourself a lot of grace about you are not the same person. I think for a little while, I really lived in this like thought of at some point this will pass and I will just become my normal self again. And I had an experience. So I had family friends. I actually was a flower girl in their wedding, and they lost one of two twins when I was about 18, and I saw him, and it had probably been about a year and a half, and since Clyde had died, and it had been, it was just like right around 21 years for them. And he said to me, he said, it's 21 years later. And he said, and there are still plenty of times where I am in the car driving to or from work and I burst into tears and I cry over Nicholas.
Yeah.
And I remember having two feelings at that moment of like, it's 21 years. Like, so this doesn't like go away, and being sort of angry about that. And then at the same time, feeling like that was very freeing to just know, like, this is what life is, okay? And so I just have to accept it, and I have to learn to live with this new normal. And
I always say there should be a switch.
Like, right.
You can turn it on and off, because
right.
it comes on when you don't want it to.
Right, exactly, for sure, for sure. And I think I say that was very freeing, because I think all of a sudden then I knew that perfection was not going to happen. And so our family was always going to be imperfect. All of a sudden, you know, it came with it that what I would have worried about before was not going to be a worry anymore. And so, you know, does my son always look 100% immaculate when we leave the house? No. You know what? I don't care.
No.
Does our son make messes, and, you know, do I not fix them? Yeah. And
so how old is he now? You had the third one.
Yeah. So he is going to be 3 in July. So he's, what are we at? Like
stupid thing.
32 months, 31 months, something like that.
Oh, almost 3.
So almost 3. Yeah. And you know, I mean, parent, you know, I know you labeled this as parenting after a loss. You know, parenting after a loss is very unique. You know, it comes with, I think for me, it's come with two things. I think I have let go of a lot of small stuff and really just am grateful for all the things. So, you know, our son has typically been a very good sleeper, but there was a period of time when he was up at 4 a.m., like every morning screaming, okay, and wanted to be up for the day. And, you know, I remember one day my husband saying to me, oh my God, I can't do this. And I said, well, you know, Colette didn't have healthy lungs, and at least we know he's got healthy lungs.
Yeah.
And, you know, just messes that he makes, right? And so, like, you know, doing this, I'm a way messier and hands-on mom than I think I would have been prior to losing Clet. And I think that's just because the things I thought were important just don't feel important.
I think you have to be present. Like, I think you learn how to become more present.
Right. Yeah.
So you are grateful for the dinners you have together and the times you wait in a lineup together. And instead of thinking, I'm in a lineup again, like, why isn't it moving?
Right, right.
I think you become more grateful.
Right. And so I think that comes with it. But it also comes with a very much a sense of fear, you know. I don't take for granted the fact that I have a healthy toddler. And I don't take that for granted. And I am afraid constantly of that. And I think one of the things that really has played out for us as parents is, you know, we so often along our journey, we played into and we landed in the like, oh, this rarely happens category. And so when they say things, you know, so we were parenting him in the height of COVID, and, you know, it took a long time for him to be able to be vaccinated. And, you know, when you bring this up to people will talk to you about, oh, the low transmission rate of kids his age. And, you know, it's really not that serious for them. They usually bounce back pretty quickly. And, you know, only in, you know, 1% of cases or whatever it is. And that probably at one point would have been a comfort. But when you've experienced and been in that 1%, in that 5% over and over and over again, you don't believe that you're not going to automatically fall into that.
Yeah.
And so you don't find that comfort. And I think that that's really, really hard to live in that and to navigate that and to not put that onto your child. Right. And so I don't want to cause my anxieties and my fears and my concerns and my PTSD and all of that, or my husband's, to affect our child. Right.
Right.
And how do you do that? And it is a constant, you know, back and forth of wanting to be there and wanting to be responsible, and also at the very same time, not wanting to put your stuff onto your children. And I think that that's a really, you know, it's a really difficult place to be in, and to balance that, you know. And I think with the gratitude, right?
Yeah.
I want to give him the world. And yet I know to raise a person that, you know, goes into society and is a citizen of society, I have to say no sometimes. And that hurts because I don't want to say no to him.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's a lot of balance, and it's a lot of having conflicting emotions sometimes and learning that they work hand in hand. So as grateful as I am for my son every single day, I also grieve my daughter and a child that I don't know if it was a boy or a girl. And I grieve that every day. And I grieve what our family looks like. Never would have imagined that we would only have one living child. That was never in our plan, never in the cards. It looks different. It looks different.
Do you have close conversations with your husband then? Or
we do. We talk very closely. We talk a lot about Clet is a regular part of our family. You know, she is brought into everybody. Grandparents all, you know that she has another, they have another child. And we, I sign all of our cards, you know, and things like that, all of this stuff. If it comes from the kids, it comes from Clet and Elliot. If it comes from all of us, it's Mark, Michelle, Clet, and Elliot, and that's just the natural thing. And so we do include her, and you know, and we do talk about when we really miss her. And there are, you know, there are some days. I mean, I will tell you, the last presidential inauguration, when Kamala Harris is our first female vice president, and I missed my daughter so much in that moment. Because
isn't
I just
that
thought
crazy
about,
like, you wonder where that comes from, don't you?
Right.
I mean, it's
and I think, you know, that was something I thought I would experience with my daughter. You know, I went, my mom, my sister and I went to go see Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, in the movie. And I got really emotional at one point because, you know, for me, I had grown up reading that book you know, and I remember going through those changes, and I remember having those experiences with my mother. And so I always thought I would have a daughter and I would have those experiences with her. And to know that I have a daughter and I'm not going to have those experiences was really, you know, in the middle of this movie, I'm sitting there in the theater crying, you know, because of all those things. I am sad that my son will not have the experience of a sibling in the way that I had it, in the way my husband has had it, in the way that most of his friends will have it. And yet I know at the same time, and I know this because I will see him, is that sometimes he will just sort of stare off into space. And I am pretty positive he is talking to Clet. And, you know, even to one point where he did that a couple months ago, he stared off and thing, and then he started laughing. And I said, well, Mom wants to know the joke. Can you and Clet tell her the joke? And he rolled his eyes at me. He like looked up to where he had been looking, and he rolled his eyes and looked up. And I thought, oh, my God, it's siblings, right? Like, this is what my sister and I did. This is what, you know, right? Like, oh my God, why is Mom being so lame? Why is, you know, all of that that we did. And I know that there's a bond. We have a bear that represents Klett. And from his first pictures, when he was maybe 2 weeks old, he will hold the hand of the bear in pictures. And it's that bear.
It's like a connection.
He knows. So on some level, you know, he knows this. And we do still talk about this, is, you know, your sister and this and that.
Do you think you'll talk about feelings with him?
Absolutely, for sure. You know, we are nothing but transparent. And so we talk about that. And, you know, we have been blessed to find other lost parent friends who are also parenting after loss. And so, you know, he is meeting other kids who have angel siblings, and hope that those relationships, you know, continue and grow for our children. Because I think, you know, one of the things I will say that I think has been my greatest savior point, you know, help, has been having a community of lost parents around, and to have that and to know that those are the people I can go to, and that I can say things like, yeah, so I, you know, this innocent thing happened, and yet I went to, and I was in my PTSD, and I might as well have been back in the NICU when they were telling me that Klett is dying. And that I can say that, and they're not like, oh my God, is something wrong with you? They're like, yeah, I get it. And I, you know, and I hope my son has lost, you know, sibling friends who understand what that looks like, and, you know, and understand that we parent differently as a result of that.
Absolutely.
And that their sibling relationships look different. And I think that that's, you know, so important too. And yeah, we talk about Klett all the time, and, you know, when I see him and he's sort of drifting off, I will say things to him like, can you just tell Klett I really, really miss her. And I'm thinking of her and I love her. And, you know, I don't know if he actually is, but I believe he is. And I believe that there is a connection. And I, you know, and I also believe that there are just sibling bonds that, you know, and space don't get rid of.
Yeah.
Actually, you're going to get to meet Elliot because it's bedtime. So I'm just saying goodnight. Oh, cool. He's coming down. So.
That's but, awesome.
Yeah.
Well, maybe after that you can, yeah.
Can you say hi? Can you say hi?
Hi, Elliot.
Yeah.
Hi.
Yeah. I know.
Your mummy's working.
Yeah. Okay. Can I get a kiss? Can I get a kiss? Can I get a kiss? Okay. Go sleep well. I love you.
It puts a whole other perspective on things, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
What about... you were saying to me backstage that you weren't prepared for, you know, guardianship in a will or that type of thing. And it's hard for parents. And I talk about this on the show all the time about that's they're ready to do the will. And then the guardianship comes up, the topic. And then they just, well, I don't know. I don't know who to use. I don't know who to ask. I don't know. And so then they stop doing it. Flatten their trails instead of just picking two or three people and giving them different jobs to do. You're going to be full-time, you're going to be part-time, you're going to be weekends and holidays, and you're going to be that person, you know, that type of thing. And I think if you could just do that for the time being until you have a different perspective on things, at least you can get the will done.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, we had just not done it yet with Klett. And I do remember at one point thinking about those kinds of things, you know, especially because my health was in such danger at various points. And
changed, you know, that whole thing too, didn't it?
Right. And so like, okay, if I don't survive this, I trust my husband. But then what happens if, God forbid, something happens to him too? And what does that look like? And so, you know, we had these like very, you know, rushed discussions in between all of this thing of like, you know, and ultimately, I mean, we're very lucky that we each have a sister that we completely trust. The two of them get along. Yeah. We knew that they were going to very much include each other in our children's lives and make sure that they were including the other side of the family. And we knew that. And so we were very fortunate, very lucky, but it was like, okay, we need to decide that is, you know, and so I honestly, I don't even know who comes first. There's like, you know, one sister and then the other.
Yeah.
But basically it's essentially, we're saying it's really the two of them and whatever that looks like. And, you know, I think it's hard, right? Because it's hard to predict, you know, if you're planning for something, you're planning for something you hope never happens, right?
Yes.
You also have to think about, like, it can happen at any point. And 18 years for a child's life is a long time. And a lot of things can happen in those 18 years. And so having those people that, you know, you may think this person is going to be the first person to do it, and you have backups, because if something happens and that person cannot do that or cannot do it full time, like you were saying, you know, and maybe there needs to be a split of some sort or something like that, then you need to figure those kinds of things out. And I think it's it's right. We don't deal with death very well in this country and the society. Like, we just really, we're afraid of death. We don't talk about it, even though it's very much a part of life. And so I think, you know, we get uncomfortable about those kinds of things. We don't want to talk about them. We don't want to think about that stuff. But it's so necessary. And I think, you know, for parents, it's really necessary, because you have to anticipate, you know, what is really important for your child to experience and learn and have even after you're gone. And so, you know, who are the people who are going to, you know, nobody's going to parent the exact same way you would, but who are the people who are going to try to be as close as possible and who are going to have the morals and the values that you think are important.
They're important. Yeah.
And, you know, and that's not always going to be, you know, the person that, you know, would be the obvious choice, right?
Yeah.
You know,
that's why I like the combination.
Right. Right.
I like that because the child, you know, sometimes people will pick, well, I'll pick my parents, but your parents are older.
Right.
And then, but maybe a different person can give them something else that they're used to. Maybe they're more used to being around the sister, or the brother, or the aunt, or the uncle. But yeah, so I think a combination is kind of nice.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's really just, you know, it's having those tough conversations of, you know, what do we think parenting looks like? What do we want, you know, our child as an adult, as a member of society, what do we want our child to be like?
Yeah.
You know, and who in lieu of us could fulfill that to the best possible.
One person, two people, three people,
right. Whatever that is, you know? Yeah. And who, you know, and I think, it's right. I mean, I shared with you the story of like, when I turned 18, the day I turned 18, my mom opened the door to my room, said happy birthday, and said, if we die, you're in charge of your sister.
That's so funny.
And that came from my grandfather was our person, and he died when I was 12. And my mom was like, we had people, but they weren't really the ideal. And so, you know, she said, I kind of held my breath and like, was just like, nothing can happen to both of us until Michelle is 18. And, you know, and I remember, you know, as an 18-year-old, 19-year-old, you know, everything, you know, laughing at my mom about this. And now kind of being on the other side as a parent, I'm like, I get that. Because if we didn't have our sisters, I don't know what we would do. And, you know, it would really take a lot of soul searching. In a lot of ways, you know, our sisters, it was easy. you know, kind of thing. It was easy to say it. And, you know, we often
keep it
joke,
in the family, so to speak.
Right. And we often joke that, you know, they, you know, people say that, you know, your mother or your father and all that. And I don't know if I believe in this, but we had been married a couple, you know, probably about 2 years or so. And all of a sudden one day I said, oh my God, we married each other's sisters. That's
oh,
what we did.
Funny?
You know, so my sister is very much like my husband, and my husband's sister is very much like me. And so, you know, I think that also is very helpful to know that these two people would be involved in their lives who have very similar personalities and values and everything to one aunt or both of us. And
I,
you know,
I think when you do come to a conclusion, I think there's some peace of mind in having that part done.
Right.
And I try to tell people that, but it's the family conversations are always difficult to have. But in our workshops, we somehow try to eliminate that part of it and have fun doing it. So,
right.
But yeah, there are family conversations that are tough.
Right.
Whether it's your parents or your kids or each other.
Right. And, you know, and I think it's really important. And I think, you know, it's also, you don't want to create more instability for your kids as this is being figured out if you are gone.
Right.
And
at any age, really.
Right. And you don't want it to be that they end up with somebody you didn't really want them to be with.
Yeah. Like the government, if you don't have it done.
Right.
The government chooses.
You know, or that, you know, if there is a member of the family that you're like, eh, I don't really want my kids raised by that person.
Yeah.
It could end up being. And, you know, and I think sometimes like that's what we also have to think about is we have to follow it all the way through to say we're not, yes, this is scary and this is, you know, a difficult conversation. It's an uncomfortable conversation. But what could be the ramifications if we don't make this decision?
Exactly.
And
that's perfect.
You know, more instability for kids at a time when they've lost both their parents is not what we want. And for them to end up with, you know, somebody who is, you know, taking over the parental role that maybe is not in line with our morals and our values.
Right.
What does that look like? And, you know, and I think it's also things like, you know, you could have the best person, but if they don't live in the area, you know, do you want to have to pull kids out of school and move kids and, you know, create that? Maybe
or
that is
maybe
your best,
a secondary or something.
Right. Maybe that is your best option. But maybe there's another option, you know, and those kinds of things. And I think that that's all really important stuff to really, you know, sit down and think
consider.
Of. And it doesn't have to be family. It doesn't have to be, you know, who everyone would assume it would be. And
you
know, right. You know, and I think, you know, that's really, that's very important to, you know, to think about and to be willing to have the uncomfortable conversations and, you know, make those decisions. And
I
again,
feel like
there are decisions.
I've been in a,
there's decisions.
Well, it's a decision and you can change it in a few years.
Right.
Anyway,
exactly. So. You can absolutely change it. And, you know, I think it's the same way that, you know, we buy car insurance or health insurance, right? We kind of hope we never have to really use it. But it's there just in case because life happens and we can't predict what's going to happen.
That's right. What I can't believe I feel like I've been watching a movie with you. what final message would you like to give the listeners?
I think I would like to say for those who have lost or who are having a difficult journey with parenthood, whatever that looks like, you know, I think it's really key to trust your gut. I think it's key to surround yourself with people who are supportive. And, you know, for me, that was people who are willing to listen. I'm going to talk about Colette as my daughter, and I'm going to do it for as long as I can speak. And, you know, people who have been uncomfortable about it just don't have a place in my life. You know, so find the people that are, find that support group, find those people who get it, whether they've walked the walk or they just are willing to sit there and listen and be there in the uncomfortable with you. I think it's really, you know, that's so important to have it. And I will say, I mean, I have, you know, I'm now thinking of it. It's really three lost mom friends. And I don't think that I make a parenting decision without some input from them. And, you know, and that's not to say that it, like, it cripples me, but, you know, it's everything from, you know, oh, I need a high chair for my kid. What high chair did you guys use? You're right. You know, just that kind of stuff too.
Yeah.
To, I kind of just lost it today and this is how I was feeling. And I need somebody else to, you know, to hear this and to know what I'm going through. Right. And I think
sometimes
that
sometimes you just so need important. To vent.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. And I think, you know, as a lost parent, it's a different venting than other things. And, you know, I think it's really important to find your people. And, you know, don't be afraid to share your story. I think one of the things that I have found out over and over and over again is, as I've shared it, is how many people either directly relate to it and have the same experience, or who are just so kind and so empathetic about it. And, you know, I think that's really important. And I would say you know, friends and family of those who have lost, it's really uncomfortable. You know, the best thing you can do is just show up. You know, you're not going to fix it.
Yeah.
You're not going to improve it. Just show up and be there in the uncomfortable.
And just put your ears on.
Right. And just show up and be there. And don't forget, you know, the children that they lost. You know, remember those things. You know, I remember that being very hard. You know, we're coming up to Mother's Day, right? And, you know, Mother's Day being very hard because I wasn't always seen as a mom. And, you know, I even got some when my son was born, you know, and we came home and it was like, oh, it's your first Mother's Day. And I was like, it's like my fifth. What are you talking about? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
And just really feeling that. And I think that that's all really important.
And
too.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
doing that. Absolutely. Oh, thank you, Michelle. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for watching. And I know somebody out there is going to want to like, share, and subscribe, and share it with others that you think are going through this or have gone through this journey or that will be, or whatever the scenario. I know there's more people like Michelle out there, and we do have to find a way to link together some way and share stories and share comments and ideas, and so that we all just want to move away from this grief, but it's stuck to us like glue. We can't get away from it. So thank you, Michelle, for being vulnerable and opening up to the story. And I'm sure lots of listeners are grateful as well.
Yes. And thank you for having me.
Oh, you're very, very welcome. I loved your story. Well, you know, I didn't love the story.
Right. I understand what you mean. I understand. Yeah.
But I appreciate your journey. I have empathy and compassion for what you've gone through. And it's just crazy what we all have to deal with sometimes. I still remember what comes to mind is Friends episode with Monica and Chandler, and they weren't able to have a baby because they're, as Chandler put it, his sperm would her uterus would kill his sperm. That's how right. He used to say it in the episode. And it was kind of a big joke, and she was looking for other ways still to have a baby like you. And it's crazy. Some people can have them so easily and some people can't. And you just don't know who you're going to be.
Right.
You know, I always say I could get pregnant just by walking through a doorway. That's how easy it was for me. But not everybody's like that, right?
So, right. Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, and men are very much want to be tough and they don't want to grieve. And they want to be Superman. But we're not Superman, you know, mm-hmm. Like Michelle says, it's life and death. And that's the way life is. And we don't have to act like nothing's going to happen because we know, you know, something will happen. We just don't know what, and we don't know when. So Don't forget to share, like, and subscribe to our show. I'd love to have you here all the time. And if you're thinking of that special someone right now that you haven't said how much you love and care about them today, please do pick up the phone, knock on their door, FaceTime them, Zoom time them, whatever it takes, but tell them how much you love and care about them today, because you don't know what tomorrow's going to bring. And you don't know. You could go to the grocery store today and not even come home. You know, like you just don't know how life is, how life takes a turn. So that being said, I always end our show with Carol Burnett. And I know Michelle knows who Carol Burnett is because we all grew up with Carol Burnett. I'm so glad we had this time together just to have a laugh or sing a song. Seems we just get started. And before you know it, comes the time we have to say so long. So long, everybody. So happy to have Michelle here with us today. And I'm so happy to have all of my listeners as well. Thank you, Michelle, for coming on our show again. And thank you, listeners. Till next week, stay safe, be kind. Till we see you again next week, thank you, and lots of love to everybody. Bye for now.